It's Friday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, France mourns the victims of the Paris attacks. We speak with Britain's ambassador to Washington.
I think the point to remember when you're dealing with this kind of terrorist threat is that the bad guys have to get lucky just once, whereas the forces of goodness and truth, the forces of law and order, have to be vigilant and successful all the time if we are to stop any attacks.
North Korean refugees adjust to life in the West, and we remember a famed New Orleans musician. It's all ahead. French President François Hollande vowed Friday to crush the army of fanatics who carried out this month's deadly terror attacks in Paris. He spoke as he presided over a national memorial service for the victims. The commemoration held at Paris's Invalides National Monument began with a somber reading of the names and ages of the 130 people who died in the attacks claimed by the Islamic State group, followed by the French national anthem. It has been 2 weeks since the team of Islamic State militants swept through Paris, setting off their suicide vests and opening fire on innocent victims in several locations, including a crowded concert hall. The ceremony was also attended by other top French leaders and families of victims, as well as hundreds of those injured in what was France's worst ever terrorist attack. In his speech, Hollande stressed the importance of unity, saying France will neither give in to fear nor hatred. But he also promised to defeat the Islamic State, which he said was driven by an insane cause and is betraying their God. The French leader this week completed a whirlwind diplomatic tour in an attempt to build a tougher international force to fight Islamic State, which controls large parts of Iraq and Syria. Britain, France's neighbor, is also confronting the terrorist threat. VOA's Carol Castiel this week interviewed the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott, at his residence in Washington. Here is an excerpt which will be aired in full on this weekend's Press Conference USA.
Well, first off, Sir Peter, we know that Prime Minister Cameron met with President François Hollande this week to talk about what to do in the wake of the terrible terror attacks. And we know that he pledged greater cooperation on all fronts, and also adding airstrikes in Syria to combat ISIL. Talk more about what came of that meeting.
Well, the Prime Minister, as you say, went to Paris and saw the President, and they went together to the site of where the biggest of the atrocities took place at that nightclub. And they did indeed discuss the way in which the British and the French can further improve their solidarity, working together to deal with the scourge that is ISIS. We haven't yet decided in the United Kingdom that we will take military action inside Syria, as we are already doing in Iraq. We're doing a great deal there in lots of different ways, whether it's encountering IED airstrikes, providing weapons for the Kurds fighting back against ISIL, or whether it's providing aerial reconnaissance and refueling to other people's fighter aircraft. We're doing a huge amount there. Inside Syria, we're doing a bit less. We've been doing some train and equip like the Americans have, and we've been providing some of the overhead intelligence and reconnaissance, but we've not been taking military action there. And what the Prime Minister has said today is that he will be making the case for a strategic approach towards the problems of ISIL in both Syria and Iraq to Parliament later this week, and that he will be seeking parliamentary approval for British military action to be extended from Iraq into Syria in the future. I don't yet know when that'll be, but that is the Prime Minister's intention. And the point that he makes, of course, completely right, is that the terrorists don't recognize any national border, so why would the British, as part of the coalition to counter that terrorist threat, recognize the border?
Indeed. We'll talk more about the Syria theater in a little bit, but I want to go to the implications for Britain about the terror attacks in France. Certainly, Britain has had its share of attacks. I'd like to get your sense of what you think might have gone wrong, particularly with respect to any kinds of intelligence failures, lack of coordination. What are the challenges and obstacles to tracking and foiling these plots?
I think the point to remember when you're dealing with this kind of terrorist threat is that the bad guys have to get lucky just once, whereas the forces of goodness and truth, the forces of law and order, have to be vigilant and successful all the time if we are to stop any attacks. So, of course, after an event like this, everybody immediately looks at the intelligence and the traces they left behind to see what more we can learn about who they were, where they came from, who tasked them, and what further risks and threats there might be. So I myself wouldn't talk about weaknesses and failures and why didn't we stop it. It is really very difficult to be 100% sure. We've all been working on this for a long time. My Prime Minister has made clear the last few months we've stopped numerous ISIL-sponsored terrorist attacks in the United Kingdom. Who knows? The next successful attack could be in any one of a number of different cities. Doesn't mean to say that our intelligence services are not geared up, expanding their operations, improving their cooperation, but it does mean that we have to be even more vigilant and we have to be as strong as we can in learning the lessons from what's gone on. And one of the things that we are doing with our French friends and with our Belgian friends and our partners across Europe, as well as here in the United States, is trying to ensure that we've all got access to the same critical information so that we can head off this kind of thing before the next atrocity.
That's Britain's ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Castiel. The entire interview airs this weekend on Press Conference USA. In other news, China has sentenced three human rights activists to harsh prison terms for participating in an anti-censorship protest in 2013. The attorney for the three, Zhang Lei, told VOA he's shocked and angered by the verdict, which gave a sentence of 6 years to activist Guo Feisheng. Zhang said the court added an extra criminal charge to his client's case just moments before Friday's trial started. Activists Liu Yongdong and Sun Desheng were sentenced to 3 years and 2.5 years, respectively, for participating in the same demonstration. The three were charged with gathering crowds to disturb social order, and Guo received the additional charge of picking quarrels and provoking trouble. Both charges are often used broadly against dissidents. The protest they took part in was a week-long peaceful demonstration in 2013 outside the headquarters of the Southern Weekly newspaper. The demonstrators called on Beijing to give up censorship practices that affected the paper. Zhang said he will be filing appeals for all three of his clients. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A number of scientists say that Earth's magnetic fields have been quickly losing strength over the past 100 years or so. Recent research suggests that because of this, Earth is on the verge of flipping its magnetic poles. But a new study finds that the field strength is merely returning to normal after reaching rather unusually high levels. Columbia University's Dennis Kent, the study's co-author, says that while Earth's magnetic field may be rapidly weakening, it's not lower than the long-term average. He also suggests that after weakening to a point, the fields may again increase in intensity. Earth's magnetic field has flipped a number of times throughout its 4.5 billion year history. The last time that happened, about 786,000 years ago, scientists said it took only about 100 years of diminishing field strength to do so. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll look back at the life and career of New Orleans musician and producer Alain Toussaint. Well, even as tensions with Turkey have increased, so Russia is dealing with its deteriorating relations with its former Soviet state, Ukraine. On Wednesday, Kiev announced its intention to switch to other natural gas suppliers and closed its airspace to Russian airlines. Russian exporter Gazprom Wednesday announced it was halting deliveries over the amount of prepayments. Ukraine's prime minister said the flight ban was essential because Russia might use its airspace to stage provocations and called it a matter of national security. Tensions between the two countries have escalated since Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine last year, and Moscow's ongoing support of separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine which has left more than 8,000 people dead. John Besmers of the Center for European Studies at the Australian National University tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Russia has launched a trade war against Ukraine and Kiev felt it had little to lose.
We need to remember, I think, that Mr. Putin's objective and that of the Russian elite is to bring Ukraine to its knees by one means or another. I think they hoped that the Minsk agreements would be a way of doing that, at least to the extent of establishing a secure protectorate in eastern Ukraine, as they have in other former communist bloc countries, and that this would force Ukraine into making concessions about the constitutionality of those protectorates. And this has not really worked for them, so I think the Russians have been upping the tempo a little. It's worth remembering that the Russians are even pursuing them over the $3 billion which was loaned to Mr. Yanukovych, and which the Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, I think, quite reasonably referred to as a bribe. We always need to remember that Ukraine is hanging on the edge of a precipice anyway in its economy as well as in its security, and that they were only able to get a bailout from the IMF on the basis that they would be able to gain some kind of closure on $15 billion of debt owed, of which $3 billion was debt owed to Russia, the $3 billion given to Yanukovych as a bribe. And Russia has recently been pursuing them uphill and down dale for that $3 billion. It seems bizarre to the common sense mind. I think that an aggressor should be able to pursue its victim for $3 billion of very, very dubious, sometimes described in technical terms as odious debt. So I think the Ukrainians don't have a great deal of choice. And I think also they're starting to flail a little bit in a rather ineffective way, perhaps, and that may be part of it. They're under pressure from all sides, and the government is losing its popularity domestically.
Well, there's a gas pipeline that runs to Europe through Ukraine from Russia. Is that going to cause problems for the rest of Europe?
In the short term, it might, but of course, Russia has plans for that. The plan is to increase the capacity of the Nord Stream lines that run to Germany. And that matter is still in the balance, but it is something that Russia is seeking to agree on with large German and other European gas interests. And the purpose of it is not economic, it's geopolitical, and it is to transfer the gas that is still going through Ukraine. Much of it already has been taken away from Ukraine and is going through Nord Stream 1. But if Nord Stream 2 is built in very short order, Ukraine would lose all its transit of gas, lose quite a lot of money, and it would give Russia potentially the capacity to strangle it of gas supplies. So the Ukrainians have, of course, been trying very hard to get out of that situation, and they have been receiving gas by reverse flow from Europeans. It's basically still Russian gas, but they're buying it from the Europeans. The Russians, however, are very unhappy with that, and they are trying to close off those options as well. So wherever you look, it is a bit of a minefield and a battlefield, and the Ukrainians, I think, are under tremendous pressure from many different sides, and they're uncertain about how much support, at the end of the day, they will get from the West. They got this reverse flow of gas, which was very good for them, but now the threat is that Nord Stream 2 might take it away from them again.
Professor Besmer says since the second Minsk ceasefire agreement in February, fighting has eased in eastern Ukraine. Well, the Refugee Processing Center, which is operated by the U.S. State Department, says there are some 190 North Korean refugees living in the United States. But there may be more who do not claim refugee status. As Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles, many North Koreans have settled in California, where they're trying to adjust to their new lives.
Many North Koreans who have left their homeland keep to themselves, and some struggle to adjust to their new lives when they arrive, like Sammy Hun, who lives in Los Angeles. In the U.S., it's capitalism, he says. The ideologies are very different. But he says he does not regret leaving North Korea and doesn't miss it. Hun's life in North Korea haunted him the first few years he lived in the U.S. The first 3 to 4 years in the U.S., I had nightmares, he says. In the dreams, he says, he is in North Korea trying to escape, and they're trying to catch him. Then the nightmares stopped. While Hun no longer has family in North Korea, most refugees leave loved ones behind. They are in constant fear for them, says Sokil Park, with Liberty in North Korea, an international organization that works with North Korean defectors and refugees. He spoke via Skype from Seoul.
That's a very serious crime in North Korea to have left the country without permission, and especially then to make it all the way to an enemy country like South Korea or the United States. You basically put a lot of danger of being accused of being a spy or something like that.
Youngkoo Kim, a pastor at the North Korean in America Refugee Center, says the refugees have lived in a culture of distrust for a long time, where every part of their lives is controlled. The North Koreans have the mindset, if the government gives you food, you eat, he says. If you're told to die, you die. Park says in the last 5 years, people in North Korea are more aware of the outside world than they were before.
You know, this includes being more aware of the difference in the systems and level of wealth and opportunity in China and even in South Korea. And partly because of the foreign media that's coming in and being watched illegally in North Korea.
Park says some of the North Koreans who have escaped have communicated with their loved ones back home through Chinese cell phones smuggled into North Korea. Park says these communications have spurred a new wave of people to flee.
Nowadays, especially for some of the young North Korean refugees, you have more people that say that they were frustrated with the system in North Korea, the lack of freedoms.
And the reason why Sammy Hun left? He says it's not because of the people or the land, it was because of the government. It may be ironic that Sammy Hun now works at a restaurant, since he talks to his son about the hunger he faced in North Korea. Hun says if Korea becomes united, he will visit, but America is his home now. For VOA News, Elizabeth Lee, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Well, the music world recently lost a giant. Alan Toussaint died this month after a performance in Spain. If you're not familiar with the name, you're very likely familiar with his music and the sounds he inspired. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and Jim Stevenson remember Toussaint's deep influence on many music genres.
We did experience a big loss, Jim. His name was Alan Toussaint. He was a singer, he was a songwriter, he was a producer, and he was a cultural ambassador for the city of New Orleans. He was born and raised there, and he was a major musical presence for six decades. He died on November 9th of an apparent heart attack just hours after performing in Madrid, Spain. He was 77.
How can we just end something that has been so much more good than bad?
Alan grew up in New Orleans. As a child, he learned to play piano in the syncopated style of Professor Longhair. And this was a distinctly New Orleans sound. And in the 1960s, he became a successful songwriter and producer in New Orleans, and some of his early hits include some pretty early rock classics like Mother-in-Law by Ernie K. Doe, Working in the Coal Mine by Lee Dorsey, The song Fortune Teller, which has been covered by many acts, including the Rolling Stones early in their career. And then in 1977, Glen Campbell had a number one hit in pop, country, and adult contemporary with a song of Allen's called Southern Nights.
Southern Nights. Have you ever felt a Southern Night?
And he also recorded a series of solo albums in the 70s, although he said he was always more comfortable behind the scenes. He started working with artists outside the New Orleans orbit, which took his career to the next level. He arranged horns for the Band. He worked with the group La Belle. He produced their signature hit, Lady Marmalade.
Your Lady Marmalade.
He collaborated with Paul McCartney and Wings. And in recent years, hip-hop artists have sampled his work, introducing him to a whole new generation. In 2006, he released an album called The River in Reverse, which was a collaboration with Elvis Costello. Alan Toussaint became a cultural ambassador for New Orleans. He entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1998. And just 2 years ago, in 2013, President Barack Obama awarded him the National Medal of Arts. So this is a loss that the music world is feeling keenly.
He had deep roots, to say the least. Fortunately, we have all the recordings to listen to. One of the greats in music history and one of the greats here at VOA, counting down the top 20.
Every Thursday right here on VOA.
Can't wait. Thanks so much for being with us, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hard on the heels of the terrorist attack in Paris, which resulted in the deaths of some 130 people, came a terrorist attack on a hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali. Prior to 2012, Mali was one of Africa's longest established democracies, but a failure to deal with ethnic tensions in the north, as well as the presence of extremist groups operating from safe havens in the north, led to a Tuareg rebellion. This rebellion was then usurped by violent extremist elements reinforced with arms and fighters from Libya. The country was destabilized, and this led to a military coup in 2012. Extremists with links to Al-Qaeda occupied large parts of northern Mali and began to institute their fundamentalist version of Sharia and brutalized the civilian population, forcing thousands to flee. The Malian government requested help. In 2012, a French military force backed by African partners from Chad and Niger under Operation Sabre disrupted and scattered extremist forces which largely fled to Tunisia and Libya. However, remnants of the extremist group continue asymmetric attacks against the Malian government as well as the United Nations peacekeeping mission. The French continue counterterrorism operations against extremists. There is good reason to believe that terrorists chose their target specifically because the hotel is popular with foreigners, and at the time of the attack was hosting a number of delegations attending peace talks. At least 22 people died, among them 6 Russians, 3 Chinese nationals, an Israeli, an American, 2 Belgians, 1 citizen of Senegal, and another from Lebanon. Many of the victims, including one American, were people who came to Bamako to help the Malian government and the Malian people through difficult times. These international efforts to restore peace, security, and prosperity in Mali will continue. The support of the U.S. government in these efforts will continue as well. The United States condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist attacks in Bamako. We extend our deep condolences to the families and loved ones of those who have been killed in this heinous attack, said U.S. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price. The United States stands with the people of Mali and will remain a steadfast partner along with other key allies and African partners fighting the terrorist groups that seek to undermine Mali's efforts to build durable peace and stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.